the story. I really pray that your spirit would help us to see this story with fresh eyes and to be convicted and encouraged as needed. We commit this time to you in Jesus' name. Amen. So the walls are white and narrow, and I peer into this slot in the door and look into this small room where a prisoner once lived. I'm with my sister in Port Arthur, and for a moment we are the only ones in this building, and it is quiet, which is exactly what this building was designed to be, quiet. No talking is allowed or was allowed. No names were to be used. In fact, sometimes they would put mats across the floor so that even your footsteps would be quiet. The prisoners would be allowed out once a day for exercise, but when they went out, they had to wear hoods over their faces. A few times a week, they'd be ushered into the chapel space, which was located in the prison, where this preacher would thunder at them, telling them how terrible they were. And the belief was that through these harsh words, through this harsh silence, they would be convicted, that they'd change, that they'd repent, that they'd no longer be criminals. It was pretty hardcore, and this was a prison that was designed for re-offenders in particular, like Henry Singleton. Henry didn't start off doing, I think, particularly hardcore stuff. He was initially caught stealing shirts, and so he got punished for stealing shirts. But he got a reputation, even after serving his time, for being, like, bad. You know, he didn't work, he was a bit dirty, people thought he was insubordinate, maybe he used threatening language. So eventually he was convicted for a second time, and they sent him off to what must have felt like the ends of the world, to a peninsula in what we now call Tasmania. And in Port Arthur, he was kind of cut off from the rest of the world, right? There's like water, there's harsh bushland, and he, alongside many others, were forced to do hard labour and encouraged to work hard. If not, you know, there's the whip out. And then if you're still a problem, you're sent to what was called the silent prison. Now, most inmates felt really alone and small in that place, but I don't know, Henry must have had some resilience from somewhere, because he actually manages to steal or get keys off some warders who are a bit drunk. So he manages to get a copy of these keys, and he's going to use these keys to escape. But in the end, he doesn't go through with it. He actually thinks, if I get caught, I'm going to be like in so much more trouble, so it's better to serve my time. So he stays there. Eventually he does get out, and we kind of lose sight of him after that. He's gone and disappeared from our records. But most inmates don't have that good story. Most inmates go insane in this place, or they die. Now, this prison at the time was considered progressive. This isn't a progressive prison model. In the 1800s, there's this famous philosopher named Jeremy Bentham who comes about, and Jeremy is interested in trying to make things better in society, and one of the areas that he focuses on is prison reform, because prisons in the UK at this time are pretty terrible. They're filthy, they're overcrowded, and physical punishment is used a lot, so a lot of inmates really suffer. And so Bentham travels to Russia to visit his brother for a time, and while he's there, he starts sketching out like new prison buildings, like trying to imagine like how could we do things differently, even at a like just thinking about the building. And so he comes up with this concept called the all-seeing concept, the Panopticon prison. It's supposed to be this like round building with this round guard tower in the middle, that's designed in such a way that the guards can see like all the prisoners, all the cells, what's happening, but the prisoners can't see the guards. And so the theory is you will never know when you might be being watched. So because of that fear, you will like regulate your behavior, because you could be like, oh, at any point I could be watched. And so he's like, this is a great system. It means like less people need to be employed. So it costs less money. The prisoners will self-regulate. And Bentham also, like, he doesn't want there to be physical punishment. So it means less physical punishment. And he encourages in his model that prisoners should be, you know, well-fed. There should be some program to help them integrate back into society. And so he writes lots of letters and he sketches all these ideas. But no one in the government is interested in his ideas. They're considered to be too expensive, and they're like, oh, it's so much easier to send all our prisoners to Australia. Like, that's the theory or what they're doing. It'd cost more to build this type of prison. Let's just ship them off to Australia and it'll be fine. So Bentham dies kind of with his ideas never being realised, and it's only, sadly for him, after his death that people revisit his ideas and they take some of them on. Not so much the caring for prisoners part, they try to drop that, but the notion of surveillance. And so they create this system called the separate treatment system. A model is developed in London, and a man named James Boyd is working there, and he loves this prison so much that he decides to import it to Australia. So around 1848, 1850, it takes a while for the building to be constructed, he creates this prison at Port Arthur. But he's like, oh, that London prison, it was like not hardcore enough. I'm going to go like even more extreme. Because in London, they had heated flooring and piped water. He's like, no, prisoners don't need that. So we don't need that. They had short sentences. He's like, no, let's make longer sentences that people are like confined in silence. And let's bring in a little bit of like physical punishment. Like, let's keep the iron shackles if needed. Now, this prison runs for around 30 years, but for all the theory of like disciplining the mind and that this will change people, there's very little change. Apart from the fact that the prisoners seem to deteriorate and get worse, there's not much positive change. And it actually is quite expensive. So after 30 years, Port Arthur closes down and this prison closes down. At Advent, the early church used to sing this. They used to sing, O key of David and scepter of the house of Israel, you open and no one can shut, you shut and no one can open. Come and lead the prisoners from the prison house, those who dwell in darkness and the shadow of death. I bound up the stairs, reach into my handbag to unlock the door, and can't find my keys. Has this happened to anybody else? I'm forever losing my keys, and I'm very thankful that I live next to the church, which has a really keypad, which is very easy to get into, and that once you're in, we have like, I don't know if you've ever been upstairs, there's this little room or box upstairs, so there's like heaps and heaps of like spare keys, so many keys, and one of them will normally help me get into the manse or into the church. I don't know what I would do if I wasn't living here. Keys are so small, right? You know, there's something we're meant to like carry with us all the time and not misplace them, but they're so small, we don't think about it unless we have forgotten it, and then we're like, you know, frantically trying to remember where we put them down. That it's weird to come across this description of Jesus as a key. Like, who thinks about keys? They're like these domestic, ordinary objects. Although maybe we have the added description of key of David. So I guess that gives a signal, okay, this is not an ordinary key. This is an object that is connected with royalty. David, as you'd be familiar with, was considered this great king in our scriptures. He's the one that our scriptures say, like, united the north and south parts of Israel, forming like the glorious kingdom of Israel, kind of the heyday of this nation. He's the one that God says, I'm going to establish an everlasting dynasty, like your dynasty is going to never end. So this kind of grand covenant is given. And then we see that David's dynasty does actually diminish. And so it's kind of a tension in the scriptures. Like, God has promised this grand future for David, but the house of David gets smaller and smaller. Now, in Isaiah, I'm sorry to mention Isaiah so soon, but in Isaiah 22, which was actually a chapter we skipped over, so I'm glad we can go back and revisit it. In Isaiah 22, there's this historical interlude where we have this guy called Sheba appear, and he is like the second in command to the king. Like, he's responsible for overseeing the palace. And for some reason, he's getting rebuked by God in this chapter for not doing a good job. It's like he has all this power, but God has looked at him and thinks he's like abusing his power. He's not using it well. And so he's going to be replaced by this guy named Ilkim. And Ilkim, I guess, to signal like his new role, is given like these sashes and robes. And then we're told in Isaiah 22 that Ilkim will be given the key to the house of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. So here's the first reference of this key. You're thinking, where did the early church get this idea from? It's from Isaiah. So this key comes to be associated with power, with royalty. But as I said, the house of David falls, and the key, whether it was a real key or not, is lost. Like, we don't have this key anymore. And so we come to the New Testament and we open up our Gospels, and we're in a time where this particular land is now ruled by the Roman Emperor. And this is an emperor that often likes to picture himself as the all-seeing one, all-seeing, maintaining order and control over this vast empire. Now, locks and keys have been around for thousands and thousands of years, but what the Romans kind of add to this is they create metal keys and metal locks, and they start to use them for hospitals and some sections of the prison. And it becomes a fashion for some wealthy Roman women to like wear like tiny keys kind of on their fingers. So like you can see and you're like, oh, they must have like treasures. And so it's like a way of like showing off your wealth, showing off your power. And a lot of different ways we try to do this. We try to, like, sometimes subtly, sometimes not so subtly, show or exert our power. And I feel like that's what the emperor is doing when we come to reading about this census in Luke 2. Luke 2, verse 1. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration and was taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. All went to their own towns to be registered. Joseph also went from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to the city of David called Bethlehem, because he was descended from the house and family of David. He went to be registered with Mary, to whom he was engaged and who was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for her to deliver her child. I don't know if you're aware, there is some debate about this census taking place, because there's no historical records outside of Luke's gospel that speak about like an empire-wide census, particularly at the time that Luke gives. And so people haven't known like what to do with this a little bit. One theory that's the current theory is that what Augustus did do, he didn't have like one census that kind of went across the whole empire at the same time. But as he came into power, slowly, like province by province, he would take like a survey gathering data. And so in this sense, he like covers the empire. And so, you know, maybe for Joseph and Mary and Luke, it feels like this empire-wide survey taking place, but it's probably more local. It's probably just looking at this province. But the purpose of the census is surveillance. It's to collect data, because when you're in power, knowledge is powerful, right? So you want to like gather as much data as possible to further the imperial interests, to like suppress any like threats that might be popping up, any military action that might need to be taken. And of course, you want to know how many people there are so you can increase taxation. Very important when you're in power. This habit is still happening in our society, but in a much grander scale than Augustus could ever imagine. As Brian shared with us today, we, our governments, big corporations, do a lot of work in surveillance because they understand that there's a lot of power when you have knowledge. And one of the tensions, which Brian touched on, is that some people have power and other people don't. So some people know a lot and kind of have that knowledge, while the rest of us don't. And so, as Brian said, there's so much data being collected about us, which we sort of know. Maybe we give our consent, like we click a quick button, but we're not really paying attention to. And then that data is used to make money for some companies, but also used to create algorithms or to profile people. And at the most scariest level, China is doing a lot of this work with surveillance and experimenting, particularly with Muslim Uyghur people. They like get profiled. I mean, I think everyone in China has like a rating. And then they find it really hard to like leave their city. So like the government will deny them based on their religion or ethnicity. And the Chinese government kind of rates people. So if you're like a good citizen, if you pay your credit, then you get rewarded. If you're like not in debt, you get rewarded. But if you criticize the government, then you can be tagged and it can make it harder for you to move around China. So that's, I guess, the most extreme or most obvious experiment of how this type of stuff can be dangerous. Now, there isn't a lot of Christians working in this space, but one Christian who's spent time thinking about the ethics of surveillance is a man named David Lyon. And he says this idea of surveillance kind of came out, as I said earlier, in the Enlightenment with Jeremy Bentham. And one of the things that a lot of the Enlightenment thinkers did was they were kind of saturated in Christian ideas, but they didn't really want to believe in God anymore. So they kind of take a lot of Christian ideas, but try to like remove God. So God is often described as like the all-seeing one, you know, watching us. And so they like say, well, let's take God out of it and place like people, a select group of like rational people kind of detached who will be able to maintain control and order over the population. And so this is a quote from Lyon. He says, "It is interesting, to say the least, that 21st century technological systems that have huge surveillance capacities may be said to have godlike features. In what follows, I suggest that while the multi-sensory forms of contemporary surveillance do in one sense parallel some elements of divine watchfulness, in another sense they do anything but." And Lyon goes on to say, what we kind of forget or like strip away is that when God watches, it's out of love. Like there's a relational aspect to it. It's not this detached rational being like overseeing stuff. God looks with compassion. And so if we're trying to think about what does it look like for us to watch, maybe we need to reclaim. I mean, Lyon is trying to be optimistic and try to present like what can Christians bring into this space? What hope is there in this space? Like to encourage us to look on others with compassion, with love. And so I think it's actually, I'm really glad Brian did share today because I think it's really important to have Christians working in this space because it's such a complex space that impacts us deeply, and to have people with this compassion and love for others, but also the knowledge and expertise is really valuable. When we look at Christmas story, the Christmas story declares that God became one of us, that God is relational, that God is embodied, that God is not this eye watching over us, but is deeply involved in our world. And in fact, you get the sense as you read Luke's gospel that he's kind of making fun of the emperor, like this all-seeing eye misses what's happening, that he misses the birth, and in fact kind of helps lead Mary and Joseph to ending up in Bethlehem as well. One of the reoccurring things in the early part of Luke's gospel that Luke wants to stress is this connection to David that this family has. I don't know if you've noticed it, but it says, you know, Joseph, Mary's fiancé, is a descendant from the house of David. The angel Gabriel, when talking to Mary, says, your child is going to receive the throne of David and rule forevermore. Zechariah, when singing after being silent for so long, celebrates that the horn of salvation is coming from the house of David. And then we get to Luke 2, and in Luke 2, we see, because of those in power, Mary and Joseph are compelled to go to Bethlehem. Now, Bethlehem is not remarkable, apart from the fact that David was born there. It's not a, I know it says city there, it's not really a city. It's a town. So it's not some place you necessarily need to visit. But because of this census, Mary and Joseph end up there and they have their child there. And all of this, Luke says, is a claim to divinity, a claim to kingship. It's a claim that Jesus could be a legitimate contender to the throne, that Jesus could be the Davidic king that Israel has been waiting for. But it's so small that you can easily miss it. Like it's a provincial town, I'm sure there's lots of women giving birth, it's just another birth, another poor peasant girl wrapping her child in a blanket. Like, it's kind of unremarkable. And in fact, people do miss it. It's not until, you know, 30 or so years later that you start to see Jesus become more visible, and you start to see, well, what type of ruler, if Jesus is going to be a king, like, what type of ruler is he going to be? And it's interesting that Jesus decides to become visible when John the Baptist has been arrested. After John is imprisoned, Jesus withdraws for a moment, and then he starts his public ministry. And one of the first things he says is that I have come to bring freedom to the prisoners. Now, today in our political climate, if you're a leader wanting to win votes, this would not win votes. You're supposed to be tough on crime, and here's Jesus saying, I'm going to set all the prisoners free. Like, that sounds really dangerous. And yet, that's Jesus' stance. Now, Jesus seems to have this concern for prisoners, and it is different. Like, prisoners in Jesus' day functioned a little bit differently to prisoners today. For one thing, you didn't tend to be in prison for a long time in Jesus' day. You tended to be in prison up until your sentence. And a lot of people were in prison in Judea at the time because they were in debt. So taxation was a real problem. They were struggling financially. Or they might have been rebels, resistors of Rome. But either way, Jesus emphasizes this throughout his career. Like, you might remember him saying, you know, care for people. And you think, yes, yes, that sounds good. You know, care for the poor, care for the homeless. But then he says, care for prisoners. Like, if you are caring for prisoners, it's like you're caring for me. There are Christians throughout history who've, like, really taken this to heart and really then try to care for prisoners, including a woman named Elizabeth Fry. She lived around the same time as Jeremy Bentham. They kind of knew one another. And she had a heart also for prison reform, particularly for women and children. She'd heard, you know, people preaching about this, and she ended up visiting Newgate Prison, which is where women and children were before they were sent to Australia. And initially, what would happen to get to the prison, to the ships, is that the women and children would be shackled onto open carts and then kind of paraded through the streets. And then, like, people would, like, you know, throw vegetables and filth at them. And so one of the things she advocated for was, like, can we not make this so public? Can they just be, like, privately transported to the ships? Like, they don't need to go through any more indignity. She also provided food, schooling opportunities for children, tried to help women gain, like, employment skills, because she said, you know, in the end, don't we want to see these people rehabilitated, integrated back into society? What happens if we showed them, like, compassion? What happens if we gave them dignity? And she did this because of her faith. Julianne Swaltzer wrote this article just last week saying, like, who are we as Australians? She's like, in some ways we have a story you can tell in two different ways. She says, in some ways we are people who come from this convict heritage. We can lock people up in lots of creative ways. And that's one story that we can embrace and live into. But she says, but you could also tell the Australian story as one where prisoners came and were set free and built society and became active and, you know, law-abiding citizens, more or less. And so our story could be one of rehabilitation. And this is a quote from her. The story of rehabilitation and renewal should be a defining one. Instead, in the incarceration nation, lock them is preferred. I think most of us would agree that there is a place for prison in our society, but I don't know if we're aware that there's still a big conversation happening about prison and what the purpose of prison is. Our prisons are at capacity across all the different states. They're at capacity, and so people are saying, well, if we want to keep people safe, we just need to build bigger prisons, right? Build bigger prisons. It might be expensive, but it's worth it because it keeps the community safe. It also costs a lot of money, not only to build prison, but, like, to care for prisoners, to feed them, house them, and that. It's quite a lot of money. But, you know, it's worth it if it keeps people safe. But other people say, but maybe we could use that money in a different way. Maybe we could use the money to work at preventative strategies, because actually when we look at who's in prison, it seems to be certain groups that are really struggling, people with mental health issues, people with drug addiction, certain ethnic or social groups like Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders are hugely overrepresented in our prisons. And it's not, you know, we don't want to be saying, well, obviously there must be more criminal. No, maybe there's something going on underneath that is shaping this that we could step in and prevent. There's also a huge discussion about, like, what is the age someone should go to prison? There's some kind of appalling stories coming out of our detention centres, youth detention centres, and one of the concerns is that once you're in prison, you're 50% more likely to reoffend and then kind of be in that system for life. And so there are people saying, maybe we can do things differently. It's probably not very popular because, as I said, our society, we do tend to prefer to, like, lock them away. Seems to be the simplest solution. But again, like the surveillance space, I think that this is a space for Christians to be in. And maybe we've forgotten that historically Christians have being champions of prison reform and working in prisons, that maybe this is a space that we can claim again and think about, what does it look like to advocate in this space, or what does it look like to minister in this space? I know that there are people who are working in this space who are Christians there, and we want to again celebrate and affirm them. We do so because we worship Jesus. Jesus, who's the key, the one who unlocks the shackles, the one who meets prisoners in the shadow of darkness and death and sets them free. Jesus sets us free physically, but also spiritually. And this is probably what we're more familiar with. In the 1970s, the French philosopher Foucault, you know him, postmodern guy, came back to Bentham's idea, and he went further. He said, you know what? We are all in a prison. He said, like, surveillance nowadays means that we all kind of self-regulate. You know, out of fear, we conform to the standards of those around us, those who have power, and we become docile and we conform out of fear. And sometimes the harshest judgments we have, like, are from our own heads. And so he was really concerned about how this was shaping us as a society. And I would agree with a lot that he would say, but I'd also add, I think there are some things that we do that are wrong as well. I don't think all standards are, like, bad and are shaping us in bad ways. I think also we would recognise as Christians that sometimes we do things that hurt people, or we seem stuck in habits that we do over and over again, and I'm like, we know it's wrong, but we still do it. Like, I keep lying. Why do I keep lying? Or I keep pursuing more and wanting more, even though I know that's probably not good. Or I use power in really damaging ways. And so the scriptures often speak about us like being shackled, like we're shackled under guilt or shame. And maybe that guilt or shame is real, or maybe we shouldn't carry it, but we do. But whatever the case, there's this sense that we're, like, kind of imprisoned. And so part of the good news that we celebrate is that Jesus sets us free from sin, that kind of Jesus even unlocks the harshest judgments we might have about ourselves and kind of leads us out and says, come on, I'm going to show you mercy. That's my response, to show you mercy. And mercy, I think, has the power to change in a way that discipline and harshness doesn't. You know, at Advent, we tell not just the story of the birth of Jesus and not even just Jesus' life and death, but we actually look to see, what is Jesus doing now, and where is Jesus going to take us? And so there's one more reference to the key of David, and it comes in the book of Revelation, where we hear Jesus speaking to, like, a series of churches. And he says this, Revelation 3, verse 7. To the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these are the words of him who is holy and true, who holds the key of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. I know your deeds. See, I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut. I know that you have little strength, that you've kept my word and have not denied my name. Jesus sees this church, and I hope you notice it's not like, I see your deeds in a, like, bad way. It's meant to be encouraging. Like, I know that you're going through a hard time. I know that you feel small. I know that you feel persecuted. But I see what you're going through. And then Jesus tries to encourage them, like, to endure. He says, you are doing so good, and this time will come to an end. I'm opening the door. There's going to be an end to this suffering. In the song we sang about Come Emmanuel, we have kind of changed the lyrics now. So we often speak about the key of David as like opening up the door to heaven. Like, you know, sometimes people imagine like a pearly gate. And if there is a pearly gate, Jesus is like flinging open the gates. He's like, this is what I'm doing. I'm opening the gates so everyone can come in. I'm going to bring heaven to earth. And that is going to be a new society, a new type of living that's marked by grace, that's marked by mercy, that's good. And so he says to this church in Philadelphia, I'm coming soon. This is what I'm doing. I'm coming soon. At Christmas, we worship the God who rehabilitates, who renews, who shows mercy. And so you might have noticed on your seats this morning, there's a tiny little key. I want you to take it out for a moment and lay it on the palm of your hand. And I want to lead you in a time of prayer. And sometimes looking at something can help us focus. We don't always have to close our eyes when we pray. But as you look at this tiny key, I want you to think about places in your life that you might need Jesus to unlock. Maybe you feel small. Maybe you feel like our church is small. We feel small against all this surveillance and data collection. If we were to talk to Jesus now, what would we want Jesus to unlock in our lives? Maybe there's shame or guilt that we carry that weighs us down. Maybe there's habits that we do again and again and we don't even know why we do this action, but we seem stuck. Maybe there's thoughts that we have which are really harsh and judgmental on ourselves that we long to be free from. Maybe there's relationships in our lives that seem stuck, that need a repair. Maybe when we look at the world around us, we get tired. We see war and it tires us. We think about the prison system and all that's wrong there and it tires us. It weighs us down. Maybe we're approaching Christmas feeling weighed down. I want to give you a moment now in the quietness of your own hearts to talk to Jesus, to bring what's weighing you down and ask Jesus to unlock, knowing that Jesus sees and looks at us with compassion. Let me give you a moment to pray and then I'll lead us in prayer. God, who in wisdom closes doors to ways that would do us harm, we confess we are a people who stubbornly persist in knocking on those doors anyway. Show us your mercy once more. God, who mercifully has opened wide the doors to life everlasting, we confess that we are a people of shut doors and high walls. Teach us to rejoice in your wide mercy that breaks down barriers and unlocks doors. Amen. You're welcome to take the little key home. It can be your little Christmas symbol, and you might want to keep using it as a way of praying.